all of that were a product of the restructuring, the economic restructuring that accompanied the development of capitalism, right? But the witch hunt was instrumental to the kind of attack on women and women's power that was necessary to in fact discipline women into these new roles. So in a sense, the witch hunt was instrumental and central to create a new female discipline and to create a new female identity and to, in fact, impose new function and new roles on women, which have not dissipated, have continued to remain, you know, throughout the history of capitalism, and functions and roles that, in fact, have naturalized women's exploitation, naturalized in the sense of hiding that exploitation and making it appear as something natural, as a fact of nature, right? And here is very much the connection between the witch hunt and the transformation in the position of women with the rise of capitalism and the slave trade and the development of slavery, the development of the plantation system, because in a sense, the situation, the roots of racism, you know, are the same as the root of sexism, right? In other words, we are, in both cases, sexism as racism are the instrument and product at the same time, right, of a situation in which you have workers that have to be without rights, workers that are exploited in conditions of slavery, in conditions of unpaid labor, in conditions of coercion, right? And in a society that proclaims itself to be a contractual society, that proclaims itself to have liberated workers, that proclaims itself to be based on contract, on exchange, on trade, right? And therefore has to hide by dehumanizing it, you know, the people that it is enslaved. At the same time in which this enslavement, for the very reason that this enslavement is essential to its process of accumulation. Okay. Now, having said that, I would say that has been very important for me and I think other feminists to have examined these developments has been also to see that these have not been one-time events, right? But in fact, the development that they were that took place, you know, at the time of the first rise of a capitalist economy, have continuously been reproposed, have continuously returned. There's been an eternal return, right? They have become structural part of capitalist society, and they have become especially evident in all those situations and moments in which, you know, a society, a pre-capitalist society, has shifted. You know, has been forced to shift, has been colonized and been forced to shift to a capitalist economy. And the few wage jobs or the few compensation existing are given to men. You know, the women become, again, reproductive workers primarily, but now with no in a condition which in which this has no value and no power. And in fact, not accidentally, every time a country has been colonized, one of the next things that you see happening has been the massification of prostitution. And this has continued down to our day. You know, this development has continued down to our day. And I think if we look at the process of globalization that has unfolded over the last 20 years, in fact, we see this developments, right, in the most clear fashion. I will only say a few words now because I want to leave time for the discussion. But I would say that first of all, you know, what globalization is and what we refer to, of course, when we talk about globalization is the extension, you know, of capitalist relation to every part of the globe, which everywhere has been accompanied by massive land expropriation, by massive expulsion of people from their land, which is the reason why, for example, we have such an, you know, phenomenal processes of world migration. People migrate because they've lost all the means of subsistence that they had, you know, at home, whether it is in Asia, Africa, or Latin America. And among the most impoverished and pauperized are, of course, women, right? And the impoverishment of women in the last 20 years on a global level, you know, we speak of the feminization of poverty, but that, you know, sociological definition does not even go near to explain and describe, you know, how desperate the impoverishment of women has been and how devalued their position in society and work has been, to the point that many women have had to sell everything they have, their body and even their children. You know, now many women have sold their womb, and even a baby market has developed, which really gives us a measure of the level of desperation that we have seen in the world. To conclude with some observation that relate to the main topic of my presentation, which is the question of violence against women and what we learn. And we can also see that as a result of the presence globalizing drive, we have also witnessed an explosion, you know, of violence against women, clearly connected to this process of devaluation and impoverishment. That again, it's reminiscent, you know, of I do not want to exaggerate, but of the times of the witch hunt. And indeed, over the last 15 years, there's been in many parts of the world also a return of witch hunting. And just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, I just saw last week, which I didn't know, a documentary about witches' camps in Ghana, which means that in the northeastern part of Ghana, over the last 10 years, camps of women who have been expelled from their villages by the men of the villages under the accusation of being witches have been formed, and up to 5,000 women now in the north of Ghana live in these camps, and clearly the expulsion of these women, you know, is being connected with the general process of impoverishment in the society, so that older women who are perceived as useless, you know, have been sent off and accused and being witches. The pressure that, you know, economic poverty is bringing, and it's causing all kinds of tension in a society, which then are, you know, at the expenses of the most vulnerable. And this is not a unique situation, because in fact in many parts of Africa, as one example, and it's not the only one, for example, women under the impact of land expropriation by the World Bank, as the land that the people have is diminishing, and you know, in many communities, men are trying to deprive women of communal land rights and even the use of land. And when women hold on to those rights, fight for those rights, they are accused of being witches. This is happening, for example, today. You know, this is happening today. It's happening, for example, in a country like Mozambique. And, you know, again, there is a very processes, events, developments are taking place that are so revealing on what must have been the climate. You know, in the 16th century, you know, when people were being kicked off their land and they were losing whatever resources that they had, their commons, their animals, and so forth. Now, I wanted to make the last point about violence and sexuality. You know, in the general climate, in the general situation of impoverishment that has been produced by the globalization process, by the neoliberal agenda, by massive unemployment, the loss of resources, precariousness, and etc., we find, in my view, a phenomenon that it's accompanied, of course, by much violence, and that I saw developing in the 16th century as I was reading the documentation on the witches, which is that in a way the redefinition of women, the redefinition of the social position of women is one that in a way turns the woman as a kind of compensation for the man for the lost means of subsistence. In fact, in the Caliban of the Witch, I spoke about the woman as the new common. You know, the women in the transition to capitalism become for men the new common. You know, they are common in the sense that they are seen as beings of nature. Their work is naturalized. It's not, the work that they do is not seen as an exploitation, but is seen as something like the water, the forest, as something that everybody can take in full hands, right? And in a sense, it's a compensation for the loss of power, for the loss of wages, for the loss of land, you know, the men and loss of autonomy the men has suffered, that is compensated by the idea of still being able to control, you know, a woman. And today, that process, I would say, it's very much, you know, in present in our society. You know, the way sexuality is used, and the way, for example, the sex industry has been reconstituted, expanded, and the pornography industry has been, restructured, which, include, gives men the right not only to which basically, you know, it defines a relationship of to the female body of between men and the female body, which is more and more violent, right? And I think it's part of this dynamic that I've been describing. Thank you.
Dr. Silvia Federici, author of Caliban and the Witch, speaking last April in Victoria, B.C. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Last week, in our reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, we left off as Gatto had been describing some of the ideas and goals of what he calls the true believers, the founders of compulsory schooling in America. When compulsory schooling laws were enacted in the late 19th century, many of the early educators produced students with finely developed intellectual skills. This, Gatto said, was considered a crisis by the people behind the school project. Quote, "Ironically, the first crisis provoked by the new school institution was taking its rhetorical mandate too seriously. From it poured an abundance of intellectually trained minds at exactly the moment when the national economy of independent livelihoods and democratic workplaces was giving way to professionally managed, accountant-driven, hierarchical corporations which needed no such people. The typical graduate of a one-room school represented a force antithetical to the logic of corporate life, a cohort inclined to judge leadership on its merit, one reluctant to confer authority on mere titles. Close quote. In response, the movers and shakers of compulsory schooling began working in the 1880s to reorganize their structure and curriculum based on a new psychological theory imported from Leipzig that held that children were machines capable of infinite adjustments. Of the success of this, Gatto said, quote, "Here in a brief progression is one window on the problem of modern schooling. It set out to build a new social order at the beginning of the 20th century, and by 1970 had succeeded beyond all expectations. But in the process had crippled the democratic experiment of America, disenfranchising ordinary people, dividing families, creating wholesale dependencies, grotesquely extending childhoods. It emptied people of full humanity in order to convert them into human resources." And that's where we left off last week, and we'll pick up with the conclusion of Chapter 5 of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, which is titled True Believers and the Unspeakable Chautauqua. John Taylor Gatto was an award-winning teacher who spent 30 years in the New York City public schools. In 1991, he quit. His experience made him realize that the educational system, such as it exists, was damaging, not improving, the intellectual abilities of young Americans. He's now one of the foremost proponents of self-directed education and home schooling. And so we continue with the underground history of American education. Gatto writes, "If you have a hard time believing that this revolution in the contract ordinary Americans had with their political state was intentionally provoked, it's time for you to meet William Torrey Harris, U.S. Commissioner of Education from 1889 to 1906. No one other than Cubberly, who rose out of the ranks of professional pedagogues, ever had as much influence as Harris. Harris both standardized and Germanized our schools. Listen to his voice from The Philosophy of Education, published in 1906. Quote, 99 students out of 100 are automata, careful to walk in prescribed paths, careful to follow the prescribed custom. This is not an accident, but the result of substantial education, which, scientifically defined, is the subsumption of the individual." Listen to Harris again, giant of American schooling, leading scholar of German philosophy in the Western Hemisphere, editor and publisher of The Journal of Speculative Philosophy, which trained a generation of American intellectuals in the ideas of the Prussian thinkers Kant and Hegel, the man who gave America scientifically age-graded classrooms to replace successful mixed-age school practice. Again, from The Philosophy of Education, Harris sets forth his gloomy vision. Quote, "The great purpose of school can be realized better in dark, airless, ugly places. It is to master the physical self, to transcend the beauty of nature. School should develop the power to withdraw from the external world." Close quote. Nearly 100 years ago, this schoolman thought self-alienation was the secret to successful industrial society. Surely he was right. When you stand at a machine or sit at a computer, you need an ability to withdraw from life, to alienate yourself without a supervisor. How else could that be tolerated unless prepared in advance by simulated Birkenhead drills? School, thought Harris, was sensible preparation for a life of alienation. Can you say he was wrong? In exactly the years Cubberly of Stanford identified as the launching time for the school institution, Harris reigned supreme as the bull-goose educator of America. He was the most influential voice teaching what school was to be in a modern scientific state. School histories commonly treat Harris as an old-fashioned defender of high academic standards, but this analysis is grossly inadequate. Stemming from his philosophical alignment with Hegel, Harris believed that children were property and that the state had a compelling interest in disposing of them as it pleased. Some would receive intellectual training, most would not. Any distinction that can be made between Harris and later weak curriculum advocates, those interested in stupefaction for everybody, is far less important than substantial agreements in both camps that parents or local tradition could no longer determine the individual child's future. Unlike any official schoolman until Conant, Harris had social access to important salons of power in the United States. Over his long career, he furnished inspiration to the ongoing obsessions of Andrew Carnegie, the steel man who first nourished the conceit of yoking our entire economy to cradle-to-grave schooling. If you can find copies of The Empire of Business, published in 1902, or Triumphant Democracy from 1886, you will find remarkable congruence between the world Carnegie urged and the one our society has achieved. Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth idea took his peers by storm at the very moment the great school transformation began. The idea that the wealthy owed society a duty to take over everything in the public interest was an uncanny echo of Carnegie's experience as a boy watching the elite establishment of Britain and the teachings of its state religion. It would require perverse blindness not to acknowledge a connection between the Carnegie blueprint, hammered into shape in the Greenwich Village salon of Mrs. Botta after the Civil War, and the explosive developments which restored the Anglican worldview to our schools. Of course, every upper class in history has specified what can be known. The defining characteristic of class control is its establishment of a grammar and vocabulary for ordinary people, and for subordinate elites, too. If the rest of us uncritically accept certain official concepts such as, quote, globalization, then we have unwittingly committed ourselves to a whole intricate narrative of society's future, too, a narrative which inevitably drags an irresistible curriculum in its wake. Since Aristotle, thinkers have understood that work is the vital theater of self-knowledge. Schooling, in concert with a controlled workplace, is the most effective way to foreclose the development of imagination ever devised. But where did these radical doctrines of true belief come from? Who spread them? We get at least part of the answer from the tantalizing clue Walt Whitman left when he said, "Only Hegel is fit for America." Hegel was the protean Prussian philosopher capable of shaping Karl Marx on one hand and J.P. Morgan on the other, the man who taught a generation of prominent Americans that history itself could be controlled by the deliberate provoking of crises. Hegel was sold to America in large measure by William Torrey Harris, who made Hegelianism his lifelong project and forced schooling its principal instrument in its role as an unrivaled agent provocateur. Harris was inspired by the notion that correctly managed mass schooling would result in a population so dependent on leaders that schism and revolution would be things of the past. If a world state could be cobbled together by Hegelian tactical manipulation and such a school plan imposed upon it, history itself would stop. No more wars, no civil disputes, just people waiting around pleasantly like the Eloi in Wells' The Time Machine, waiting for teacher to tell them what to do. The psychological tool was alienation. The trick was to alienate children from themselves so they couldn't turn inside for strength. To alienate them from their families, religions, cultures, etc., so that no countervailing force could intervene. Carnegie used his own considerable influence to keep this expatriate New England Hegelian the U.S. Commissioner of Education for 16 years, long enough to set the stage for an era of, quote, scientific management, or Fordism, as the Soviets called it in American schooling, long enough to bring about the rise of the multi-layered school bureaucracy. But it would be a huge mistake to regard Harris and other true believers as merely tools of business interests. What they were about was the creation of a modern living faith to replace the Christian one which had died for them. It was their good fortune to live at precisely the moment when the dreamers of the empire of business, to use Emperor Carnegie's label, for an Anglo-American world state, were beginning to consider worldwide schooling as the most direct route to that destination. Both movements, to centralize the economy and to centralize schooling, were aided immeasurably by the rapid disintegration of old-line Protestant churches and the rise from their pious ashes of the social gospel ideology, aggressively underwritten by important industrialists who intertwined church-going tightly with standards of business, entertainment, and government. The experience of religion came to mean, in the words of Reverend Earl Hoon, the best social programs money can buy. A clear statement of the belief that social justice and salvation were to be had through skillful consumption. Shaler Matthews, Dean of Chicago's School of Divinity, editor of Biblical World, president of the Federal Council of Churches, wrote his influential Scientific Management in the Churches of 1912 to convince American Protestants they should sacrifice independence and autonomy and adopt the structure and strategy of corporations. Quote, if this seems to make the church something of a business establishment, it is precisely what should be the case, close quote. If Americans listened to the corporate message, Matthews told them, they would feel anew the spell of Jesus. In the decade before World War I, a consortium of private foundations drawing on industrial wealth began slowly working toward a long-range goal of lifelong schooling and a thoroughly rationalized global economy and society. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Frances Fitzgerald, in her superb study of American textbooks, America Revised, notes that school books are superficial and mindless, that they deliberately leave out important ideas, that they refuse to deal with conflict. But then she admits to bewilderment. What could be the plan behind such texts? Is the composition of these books accidental or deliberate? Sidestepping an answer to her own question, Fitzgerald traces the changeover to a pair of influential NEA reports published in 1911 and 1918, which reversed the scholarly determinations of the Blue Ribbon Committee of Ten report of 1893. That committee laid down a rigorous academic program for all schools and for all children, giving particular emphasis to history. It asserted, the purpose of all education is to train the mind, close quote. The NEA reports of 1911 and 1918 denote a conscious abandonment of this intellectual imperative and the substitution of some very different guiding principles. These statements savagely attack the, quote, bookish curricula, which are responsible for leading tens of thousands of boys and girls away from pursuits for which they are adapted toward pursuits for which they are not, like independent businesses, invention, white-collar work, or the professions. Books give children, quote, false ideals of culture. These reports urge the same kinds of drill which lay at the core of Prussian commoner schools. An interim report of 1917 also proposes that emphasis be shifted away from history to something safer called social studies. The thrust away from any careful consideration of the past, so that attention might be focused on the future. That 1918 NEA report, Cardinal Principles of Secondary Education, for all its maddening banality, was to prove over time one of the most influential education documents of the 20th century. It decreed that specified behaviors, health, and vocational training were the central goals of education, not mental development, not character, not godliness. Fitzgerald wrote she could not find a name for the ideology that lies behind these texts. The way they handle history, for instance, is not history at all, but a catechism of American socialist realism. More than once she notes, quote, actual hostility to the notion of intellectual training. Passion, in partnership with impatience for debate, is one good sign of the presence of true belief. The most visible clue to the degree true belief was at work in mass schooling in the early decades of this century is the National Education Association's 1918 policy document, written entirely in the strange narcotic diction and syntax of official pedagogy, which makes it almost impenetrable to outsiders. Cardinal Principles announces a new de-intellectualized curriculum to replace the famous recipe for high goals and standards laid out three decades earlier by the legendary Committee of Ten, which declared the purpose of all education to be the training of the mind. This new document contradicted its predecessor. In a condemnation worth repeating, it accused the Older Testament of forcing impossible intellectual ambitions on common children, of turning their empty heads, giving them false ideals of culture. The weight of such statements, full of assumptions and implications, cannot easily be felt through its abstract language. But if you recognize that its language conceals a mandate for the mass dumbing down of young Americans, then some understanding of the magnitude of the successful political coup which had occurred comes through to penetrate the fog. The repudiation of the Committee of Ten was reinforced by a companion report proposing that history, economics, and geography be dropped at once. What Cardinal Principles gave proof of was that the stage one of a silent revolution in American society was complete. Children could now be taught anything, or even taught nothing, in the part-time prisons of schooling, and there was little any individual could do about it. Bland generalities in the document actually served as potent talismans to justify the engineering of stupefaction. Local challenges could be turned back, local challengers demonized and marginalized, just by waiving the national standards of cardinal principles as proof of one's legitimacy. Venal motives, as well as ideological ones, were served by the comprehensive makeover of schooling, and palms incidentally greased in the transition soon found themselves defending it for their own material advantage. Schools quickly became the largest jobs project in the country, an enormous contractor for goods and services, one always willing to pay top dollar for bottom-shelf merchandise, in a dramatic reversal of economic theory. There are no necessary economies in large-scale purchasing. School is proof of that. Cardinal Principles assured mass-production technocrats they would not have to deal with intolerable numbers of independent thinkers, thinkers stuffed with dangerous historical comparisons, who understood economics, who had insight into human nature through literary studies, who were made stoical or consensus-resistant by philosophy and religion, and given confidence and competence through liberal doses of duty, responsibility, and experience. The appearance of cardinal principles signaled the triumph of forces which had been working since the 1890s to break the hold of complex reading, debate, and writing as the common heritage of children reared in America. Like the resourcefulness and rigors of character that small farming conveyed, Complex and active literacy produces a kind of character antagonistic to hierarchical, expert-driven, class-based society. As the nature of American society was moved deliberately in this direction, forges upon which a different kind of American had been hammered were eliminated. We see this process nearly complete in the presentation of cardinal principles. We always knew the truth in America, that almost everyone can learn almost anything or be almost anything. But the problem with that insight is that it can't coexist with any known form of modern social ordering. Each species of true belief expresses some social vision or another, some holy way to arrange relationships, time, values, etc., in order to drive forward a settlement of the great question, why are we alive? The trouble with a society which encourages argument, as America's did until the mid-20th century, is that there is no foreseeable end to the argument, no way to lock the door and announce that your own side has finally won, no certainty. Our most famous true believers, the Puritans, thought they could build a city on the hill and keep the riffraff out. When it became obvious that exclusion wasn't going to work, their children and grandchildren did an about-face and began to move toward a totally inclusive society, though not a free one. It would be intricately layered into social classes like the old British system. This time, God's will wouldn't be offered as reason for the way things were arranged by men. This time, science and mathematics would justify things, and children would be taught to accept the inevitability of their assigned fates in the greatest laboratory of true belief ever devised, the compulsion schoolhouse. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. One man left us a dynamic portrait of the great school project prematurely completed in miniature. William James, an insider's insider, foremost and first psychologist of America, brother of novelist Henry James. James Prestige is a formidable Boston Brahmin launched American psychology. Without him, it's touch and go whether it would have happened at all. His Varieties of Religious Experience is unique in the American literary canon. No wonder John Dewey dropped Hegel and Herbart after a brief flirtation with the Germans and attached himself to James and his philosophy of pragmatism, which is the Old Norse religion brought up to date. But James was too deep a thinker to believe his own screed fully. In a little book called Talks to Teachers, which remains in print today over 100 years after it was written, James disclosed his ambivalence about the ultimate dream of schooling in America. It was no Asiatic urge to enslave, no Midas fantasy of unlimited wealth, no conspiracy of class warfare, but only the dream of a comfortable, amusing world for everyone. The closest thing to an Augustan pastoral you could imagine, the other side of the British imperial coin. England's William Morris and John Ruskin, and perhaps Thomas Carlyle, were the literary godfathers of this dream society to come, a society already realized in a few cloistered spots on earth, on certain great English estates, and at the mother center of the Chautauqua movement in western New York. In 1899, James spoke to an idealistic new brigade of teachers recruited by Harvard, men and women meant to inspire the new institution then rising swiftly from the ashes of the older neighborhood schools, private schools, church schools, and home schools. He spoke to the teachers of the dream that the entire planet could be transformed into a vast Chautauqua. Before you hear what he had to say, you need to know a little about Chautauqua. On August 10, 1878, John H. Vincent announced his plan for the formation of a study group to undertake a 4-year program of guided reading for ordinary citizens. The Chautauqua Literary and Scientific Circle signed up 200 people in its first hour, 8,400 by year's end. 10 years later, enrollment had grown to 100,000. At least that many more had completed the 4 years or fallen out after trying. In an incredibly short period of time, every community in the United States had somebody in it following the Chautauqua Reading Program. One of its teachers, Melville Dewey, developed the Dewey Decimal System, still in use in libraries. The reading list was ambitious. It included Green's Short History of the English People, full of specific information about the original Anglo-Saxon tribes and their child-rearing customs, details which proved strikingly similar to the habits of upper-class Americans. Another Chautauqua text, Mahaffey's Old Greek Life, dealt with the utopia of classical Greece. It showed how civilization could only rise on the backs of underclass drudges. Many motivations to go Chautauqua existed. Love of learning, the social urge to work together, the thrill of competition in the race for honorary seals and diplomas which testified to a course completed, the desire to keep up with neighbors. The Chautauqua movement gave settlers of the Midwest and Far West a common Anglo-German intellectual heritage to link up with. This grassroots vehicle of popular education offered illustrations of principles to guide anyone through any difficulty. And in Chautauqua, New York itself, at the Mother Center, a perfect jewel of a rational utopia was taking shape, attended by the best and brightest minds in American society. You'll see it in operation just ahead with its soda pop fountains and model secondary schools. The great driving force behind Chautauqua in its early years was William Rainey Harper, a Yale graduate with a Ph.D. in philology, a man expert in ancient Hebrew, a prominent Freemason. Harper attracted a great deal of attention in his Chautauqua tenure. He would have been a prominent name on the national scene for that alone, even without his connection to the famous publishing family. John Vincent, Chautauqua's founder, had been struck by the vision of a world college described in Bacon's Utopia, one crowded and bustling with international clientele and honored names as faculty. Quote, Chautauqua will exalt the profession of teacher until the highest genius, the richest scholarship, and the broadest manhood and womanhood of the nation are consecrated to this service, close quote, Vincent once said. His explanation of the movement. We expect the work of Chautauqua will be to arouse so much interest in the subject of general liberal education that by and by in all quarters young men and women will be seeking to obtain such education in established resident institutions. Our diploma, though radiant with 31 seals, shields, stars, octagons, would not stand for much at Heidelberg, Oxford, or Harvard. An American curiosity, it would be respected not as conferring honor upon its holder, but as indicating a popular movement in favor of higher education, close quote. Chautauqua's leaders felt their institution was a way station in America's progress to something higher. By 1886, Chautauqua was well known all over. The new University of Chicago, which Harper took over 5 years later, was patterned on the Chautauqua system, which in turn was superimposed over the logic of the German research university. Together with Columbia Teachers College, Yale, Michigan, Wisconsin, Stanford, and a small handful of others, Chicago would provide the most important visible leadership for American public school policy well into the 20th century. At the peak of its popularity, 8,000 American communities subscribed to Chautauqua's programmatic evangelism. The many tent circuit Chautauquas simultaneously operating presented locals with the latest ideas in social progress, concentrating on self-improvement and social betterment through active reform with a capital R. But in practice, entertainment often superseded educational values because the temptation to hype the box office draw was insidious. Over time, progress came to be illustrated dramatically for maximum emotional impact. Audience reactions were then studied centrally, and adjustments were made in upcoming shows using what had been learned. What began as an education ended as show business. Its legacy is all over modern schooling in its spurious concept of motivation. Tent Chautauqua did a great deal to homogenize the United States as a nation. It brought to the attention of America an impressive number of new ideas and concepts, always from a management perspective. What seemed even-handed was seldom that. The classic problem of ethical teaching is how to avoid influencing an audience to think a certain way by use of psychological trickery. In this, Chautauqua failed. But even a partial list of developments credited to Chautauqua is impressive evidence of the influence of this early mass communication device, a harbinger of days ahead. We have Chautauqua to thank in some important part for the graduated income tax, for slum clearance as a business opportunity, juvenile courts, the school lunch program, free textbooks, a, quote, balanced diet, physical fitness, the campfire girls, the Boy Scout movement, pure food laws, and much, much more. One of the most popular Chautauqua speeches was titled Responsibilities of the American Citizen. The greatest responsibility was to listen to national leaders and get out of the way of progress. Ideas presented during Chautauqua Week were argued and discussed after the tents were gone. The most effective kind of indoctrination, according to letters which passed among Chautauqua's directors, is always self-inflicted. In the history of American orthodoxies, Chautauqua might seem a quaint sort of villain, but that's because technology soon offered a way through radio to Chautauqua on a grander scale, to Chautauqua simultaneously from coast to coast. Radio inherited Tent Chautauqua, presenting us with model heroes and families to emulate, teaching us all to laugh and cry the same way. The great dream of utopians, that we all behave alike like bees in a hive or ants in a hill, was brought close by Chautauqua, closer by radio, even closer by television, and to the threshold of universal reality by the World Wide Web. The chapter in 19th century history which made Chautauqua the harbinger of the new United States is not well enough appreciated. Ideas like evolution, German military tactics, Froebel's kindergartens, Hegelian philosophy, cradle-to-grave schooling, and systems of complete medical policing were all grist for Chautauqua's mill. Nothing was too esoteric to be popularized for a mass audience by the circuit of Tent Chautauqua. But above all, Chautauqua loved science. Science was the commodity it retailed most energetically, a new religion for a new day. The Chautauqua operation had been attractively planned and packaged by a former president of Masonic College, Georgia, William Rainey Harper, a man whose acquaintance you made on the previous page. Dr. Harper left Chautauqua eventually to become Rockefeller's personal choice to head up a new German-style research university Rockefeller brought into being in 1890, the University of Chicago. He would eventually become an important early patron of John Dewey and other leading lights of pedagogy. But his first publicly acclaimed triumph was Chautauqua. Little is known of his work at Masonic College. Apparently, it was impressive enough to bring him to the attention of the most important Freemasons in America. The real Chautauqua was not the peripatetic tent version, but a beautiful Disney-like world on a lake in upstate New York. William James went for a day to lecture at Chautauqua and stayed for a week to marvel and learn. His exact words of self-introduction to those teachers he spoke to long ago at Harvard. What he saw at Chautauqua was the ultimate realization of all reasonable thought solidified into one perfect working community. Utopia for real. Here it is as James remembered it for students and teachers. A few summers ago, I spent a happy week at the famous assembly grounds on the borders of Chautauqua Lake. The moment one treads that sacred enclosure, one feels oneself in an atmosphere of success. Sobriety and industry, intelligence and goodness, orderliness and reality, prosperity and cheerfulness pervade the air. It is a serious and studious picnic on a gigantic scale. Here you have a town of many thousands of inhabitants beautifully laid out in the forest and drained, and equipped with means for satisfying all the necessary lower and most of the superfluous higher wants of man. You have a first-class college in full blast. You have magnificent music, a chorus of 700 voices, with possibly the most perfect open-air auditorium in the world. You have every sort of athletic exercise, from sailing, rowing, swimming, bicycling, to the ball field and the more artificial doings the gymnasium affords. You have kindergarten and model secondary schools. You have general religious services and special clubhouses for the several sects. You have perpetually running soda water fountains and daily popular lectures by distinguished men. You have the best of company and yet no effort. You have no diseases, no poverty, no drunkenness, no crime, no police. You have culture, you have kindness, you have equality, you have the best fruits of what mankind has fought and bled and striven for under the name of civilization for centuries. You have, in short, a foretaste of what human society might be, were it all in the light, with no suffering and dark corners. Close quote. Flickering around the edges of James' description is a dawning consciousness that something is amiss. Like those suspicious of some innocent character on an old Twilight Zone show, it's so peaceful, so pretty, and clean, it looks like harmony, but I just have this terrible feeling that something is wrong. When James left Chautauqua, he realized that he had seen spread before him the realization on a sample scale of all of the ideals for which a scientific civilization strives: intelligence, humanity, and order. Then why his violently hostile reaction? What a relief, he said, to be out of there. There was no sweat, he continued disdainfully, in this unspeakable Chautauqua. No sight of the everlasting battle of the powers of light with those of darkness. No heroism, no struggle, no strength, no strenuousness. James cried aloud for the sight of the human struggle, and in a fit of pessimism he said to the schoolteachers, quote, "An irremediable flatness is coming over the world. Bourgeoisie and mediocrity, church sociables and teachers' conventions are taking the place of the old heights and depths. The whole world, delightful and sinful as it may still appear for a moment to one just escaped from the Chautauquan enclosure, is nevertheless obeying more and more just those ideals sure to make of it, in the end, a mere Chautauqua assembly on an enormous scale." Close quote. A mere Chautauqua assembly? Is that all this monument to intelligence and order adds up to? Realizing the full horror of this country's first theme park, James would seem to have experienced an epiphany. Quote, "The scales seemed to fall from my eyes, and a wave of sympathy greater than anything I had ever before felt with the common life of common men began to fill my soul. It began to seem as if virtue with horny hands and dry skin were the only virtue genuine and vital enough to take account of. Every other virtue poses. None is absolutely unconscious and simple, unexpectant of decoration or recognition like this. These are our soldiers, I thought. These are our sustainers. These are the very parents of our lives." Close quote. Near the end of his life, James finally understood what the trap was: an overvaluation placed on order rational intelligence, humanism, and material stuff of all sorts. The search for a material paradise is a flight away from humanity into the sterile non-life of mechanisms where everything is perfect until it becomes junk. At the end of 1997, Chautauqua was back in the news. A young man living there had deliberately infected at least 9 girls in the small town adjoining, and perhaps as many as 28 with AIDS. He picked out most of his victims from the local high school, looking for, as he put it, young ladies in a risk-taking mode. A monster like this AIDS predator could turn up anywhere naturally, but I was struck by the irony that he had found the very protected lakeside hamlet with its quaint 19th-century buildings and antique shops, this idyllic spot where so many of the true beliefs of rationality made their American debut, as the place to encounter women unprepared to know the ways of the human heart. In a risk-taking mode, as he puts it in instructively sociological jargon. Have over 100 years of the best rational thinking and innovation the Western world can muster made no other impact on the Chautauqua area than to set up its children to be preyed upon? A columnist for a New York paper, writing about the tragedy, argued that condom distribution might have helped, apparently unaware that the legitimization of birth control devices in the United States was just one of many achievements claimed by Chautauqua. Other remarks the reporter made were more to the point of why we need to be skeptical whether any kind of schooling, and Chautauqua's was the best human ingenuity could offer, is sufficient to make good people or good places. Quote, "The area has troubles and social problems of everywhere. Its kids are lonely in a crowd, misunderstood, beyond understanding and seeking love, as the song says, in all the wrong places. Once intact families, tightly knit neighborhoods, and stay-at-home mothers and forced community norms. Now the world is the mall, mothers work, and community exists in daytime television and online chat rooms." Close quote. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, and that was the conclusion of Chapter 5, True Believers and the Unspeakable Chautauqua. John Taylor Gatto is a former award-winning veteran school teacher from New York City, now a proponent of self-directed education and homeschooling. He has a website where you can download this book and find out more about Gatto and his projects at johntaylorgatto.com. That's spelled G-A-T-T-O. And you can download MP3s and podcasts of this and all previous shows at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. And our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.